Okay, can you tell me your name, please? Right.
My name's Nick Paxman. I'm a director of Ocala Construction, and we're the developers who are undertaking the redevelopment and rebuilding of the Burnbanks village. Our involvement in the village now originated when the village came up for sale through a estate agent when United Utilities decided they were going to dispose of it. And that was probably about 5 years ago. You might already have documented just when the sale took place, because my memory doesn't tie that exactly, but the property came up for sale through a land agency specialist, and we saw the details of it then. And Trevor and I looked at it, and it was just one of those places that we instantly fell in love with. It was it was obviously going to be a very complicated property development, and one that was going to take quite some long time to work out, with all the difficulties around some properties still being developed, some prefabricated properties, some not, and not least of which because of the very environmentally sensitive area that it was in. It then took us about 3 years to get through the legal stages and the environmental stages of the development up to us starting on site on the 1st of May 2004, and therefore we've now been on site for 18 months to the stage now. We started with the demolition of the properties, and that gave quite a fascinating insight into the construction of the properties. It's a long time since they went up, so probably not too many people around who actually put them up at the time. They're a cast iron prefabricated construction, of which I've never seen anything like it anywhere else. I've spent 25 years of my working life entirely in property throughout the Northwest, in a general practice chartered surveyor role in the last 10 years in property development. And although I've come across umpteen different sorts of concrete prefabricated designs, the majority dating from just after the war when the building material shortage was on, I've never seen any built of cast iron before. Neither has anybody else who's ever been here ever seen them anywhere else. They were very much a kit form construction. Each of the panels in the properties were numbered, and from what we've been able to discover, there were different shaped pieces numbered B1 through to 7, and that seems to be the only 7 pieces that were used in any of the different properties. Whether they were the semi-detached ones, whether they were the office buildings in the workshop, they covered all the different shapes that you had in a wall, in a corner post, above and below a window, and over a door head with 7 different pieces. And I suppose if you think of Lego, you can similarly build any sort of house or car or castle out of probably no more than 7 different sized pieces of Lego. So the principle was probably an easy one to follow. Those cast iron panels were just bolted together with iron bolts. Quite amazing, and I think it probably shows how the walls of the properties kept the damp out. We were actually able to undo the bolts in probably 99% of the cases. So they sat there in the wall for 75 years or whatever it is, and hadn't corroded to any point that they wouldn't just come off with an airline and a spanner on the end. So we did dismantle the majority of the properties bit by bit rather than just driving over the top of them. They were built with basically no foundation. The base of the properties was an iron girder frame, a normal H-section girder, what most people would call an RSJ, but in modern parlance is a universal beam, but an H-section girder. was laid on the ground, and the bottom panels were just bolted into that girder. Now, because that was normal iron, mild steel, whatever it is, they were very heavily corroded in most instances. And that was probably why, if you looked around the majority of the properties, and sat here inside number two, you can see it in here as well, the external walls were beginning to bow ever so slightly. And you could see this down the sides of the door frames, and where the internal partitions join the outside walls, you could see that all of them were suffering the same sort of fatigue, and the front walls were very gradually becoming the shape of a banana, which I think was due to the fact that this girder that they were sat on was just corroding away, and so that was just beginning to sag under the weight of the cast iron.
That was just on the ground, was it?
That was just sat on the ground.
Yes.
In one or two places where they'd obviously contoured the ground slightly, in each corner of the building there was a small concrete pile. I don't think any of them were more than a couple of feet deep from the ones that we dug up, so nowhere did they have anything what we would constitute a proper foundation. The floor was then just laid between these iron girders on a very shallow layer of gravel. About half the floors under the wet rooms, under the bathroom, the kitchen and the pantries, were done in solid concrete. The rest of the floors were a timber floor, but those timber joists were just sat on top of this very thin layer of oversight gravel, and they were all very badly rotten. And in one or two of the properties you could see where some repairs had been done over the years, because the floorboards were all getting a bit rotten. The roofs were covered with an asbestos cement tile, which was a very lightweight roof.
On wooden rafters?
The roof construction was a traditional timber rafter roof. What then went over the top is common with all lightweight coverings. Properties with cedar shingles are done the same way. The whole of the roof was then covered with 4 or 5 by 1 timber in proper building terms. It was put on as a sarking board. It's how they build traditionally in Scotland, that they cover the whole roof in timber and then nail the lightweight tiles on top of it. So when you gives you a bit more protection from the rain when it comes in, so you can take the tiles off and you've still got a solid timber roof, plenty of cracks in it for the rain to get through. So that was largely how we found the construction of them. I can't think of anything else particularly peculiar about the construction.
What happened to the cast iron panels and all the various bits and pieces after you dismantled
them? The cast iron panels, I did my best to ensure we kept an intact one of each piece to go to the History Society. The rest disappeared off in wagons, and the way of the world at the moment, it all went by sea to fuel China's booming economy, being the place that most scrap is now heading to, as we can't keep up with the production. So yes, all the rest of them went by road down to Liverpool docks and then disappeared off to China.
So you would have sorted the bits and pieces into iron, wood?
Because the construction internally was very, very flimsy, for want of a better description. There was no plaster work, no plasterboard, no plastering of any description within the properties. The inside lining of the cast iron was a very, very thin fibre board, the sort that people might sort of recollect from school notice boards in years gone by. A very, very lightweight.
How was that fixed on?
That in the larger square cast iron panels, there was a square in the middle where a chock of wood was banged in, and then a fairly small timber stud was nailed onto that, and then this fibre board was just nailed over the top of it. So you know, the houses must have suffered all the extremes of temperature, You know, the insulation qualities were absolutely zero, so they must have been perishingly cold in the winter, and potentially, particularly, you know, the fronts were facing south, they must have warmed up like a storage heater in the summer, with the heat getting absorbed by the cast iron and staying there for quite some time. It appears, although we've no time into it, it appears the chimneys were changed on a lot of the properties. When we stripped the asbestos tiles off the roof, there was evidence that a lot of them had wood-burning stoves with stove chimneys sticking out through the roof, because there were lots of little round holes in the timber sarking which had been covered over. And I think on some of the old photographs that I've seen, there was little evidence of the brick-built chimney stacks that existed in the properties when we came along. So I think at some stage, some alteration was made, that in the original properties they probably had a lot of little potbelly stoves with stove pipes, and at some time later they've added the chimney stacks, which were built in Whitehaven red brick. When you knock them down, they've got Whitehaven stamped through them, like okay. Blackpool Rock.
Yes. And what happened to the wood, I believe? A lot of the wood got taken away.
The wood, I hate to, well, not hate to, but when we started the demolition, the wood is unfortunately not recyclable from our point of view in building. So we did start burning quite a lot of the timber initially. And then one person would come along and ask if they could have a few bits of this, and so we were gladly saying, spread the word, and slowly more and more people appeared from out of the local area with trailers and even a couple of tractors and trailers, and quite a lot of it did get taken away. Now, I know some farmers have reused it into making sheep rails and sheep pens. I know some's gone into terracing gardens and holding up borders around people's gardens, and the RSPB working next to us in their tree nursery have used a lot of it for relining the beds and borders of the tree nurseries. So I'm pleased to say that a fair chunk of it managed to get recycled into various other activities.
Could you tell what sort of wood it was?
Not really.
We didn't have any stamps on it.
There was something on one, and I can't for the life of me remember what it was. I know David Shackleton from the RSPB, he pointed it out to me at the time he was taking some, but I can't remember what it said on it. And if he hasn't remembered it and reported it on his interview, then we're a bit scuppered on that.
Okay. Right. And what about inside? Presumably, I believe the oaks was almost as it had been years ago, whereas some of the houses would have been improved quite a lot inside.
There have been some other internal alterations done. A couple of the properties still had the old solid fuel fired boiler, whatever you call them, that people would have done the washing in.
The big iron pot.
Can't think what their proper name of said thing is. One or two of those still have that in. We did try very hard to recover. We tried in two properties to recover one intact for the History Society, but they were cast iron as well, and they were very well built into the brickwork around them. And we got one out still encased in a load of brick, but in trying to chisel the bricks off, then that one broke as well. So I'm afraid we failed on that. Right. But yes, I mean the surviving properties that were still occupied had variously had new domestic hot water systems put in. You know, they had modern copper hot water cylinders, and electric immersions had been put in. A couple of them had fairly recent bathrooms put in, but the vast majority were still the original cast iron bath and high level suite in the WC. There had been very little other modernisation done, really, from that. Those slightly newer ones had been electrically rewired. The one or two pairs that were here when we came along, had been empty for many, many years, it had still had the remnants of, you know, Wilex wiring in.
So what sort of wiring?
Originally, there had been the Wilex, the three straight pins, you know, and the cabling was either lead covered or cloth covered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was two square pins with a little red pin in the middle. From those of us who can still remember such olden days. but you know, otherwise, I don't think particularly, you know, the water board had ever seen fit to spend very much money on them at all.
No, various people have talked about spending their own money.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, I mean, I think in those terms, you know, as you would find with other long-term rented property, it did sort of come down to if somebody wanted something doing, you know, they either did it themselves or it didn't get done. I dare say, you know, any major repair would have been done, but you know, wholesale modernisation wasn't sort of likely to take place. The only other sort of main part of the village and the development that we've had a big building involvement in has been replacing the whole of the drainage system. The drainage system for its age was not unusual, but the foul water and the surface water, the roof water and the drains all went down the same pipe, which went into a clinker bed rotating treatment plant.
That was the thing down
in the wood behind the oaks. Mm. What must always have been a problem with that was when it rained very heavily and you'd get a surge of top water coming off all the roofs, it must always have caused some degree of pollution because the disposal in a soakaway would only cope with, you know, a trickle of water, and it would always have caused some degree of pollution down into the woods when it rained heavily. It's probably just from that side, it was probably good that there's only been a few people living here for the last number of years. Mm. Otherwise, the state of it would have been somewhat worse. So
that was sewage as well.
Yes.
Was it? So,
yeah.
Right.
So we
would have coped with the whole village when it was
that was fully the only system for the whole village. And yes, it must have been quite a problem when it rained a lot before. So I mean, we've now separated that, and we now have a separate foul drainage system, and we've installed one of the new biodisc package treatment plants, and we've put a reed bed in behind that as well. So they're both now situated in roughly the same place in the wood down behind what was the oaks, so basically in the same place that it was before, but it's now a very, very clean system, and the reed bed was only planted up earlier this year, so there aren't many reeds yet to see, but in another year or two it will be a very good wildlife habitat in itself, which is one of the attractions of the reed beds, because it's a good environmental habitat.
Yes. And that deals with the solids as well as the waste water.
Yeah.
Oh, excellent. But what about the wildlife you mentioned earlier? The sorts of wildlife.
Yes, I mean the wildlife has been from a work point of view, it's been a truly tremendous part of the countryside to work in. You know, the wildlife that we've enjoyed watching while we've been working here has been a joy. We've seen the roe deer and the red deer. We've seen actually walking through the village itself. We have dozens and dozens and dozens of rabbits. As most people will know, we have a very healthy red squirrel population around here as well. And you know, foxes and badgers are both also readily seen in the area. And with the demolition of the buildings and the building of the new ones, a number of bat habitats were surveyed in the area, and several species of bats roost in and around the village as well. So it truly is a wildlife hardly say oasis, but it's a very, very beautiful rich wildlife habitat that we've got.
Yeah, And birds as well.
Birds, yes, birds aren't my specialist subject.
I'll ask Dave about that.
I mean, apart from lots of the obvious ones, I've certainly seen, both heard and seen, within the village, woodpeckers, along with all the usual sort of woodland birds you'd expect.
Have you come across the remains of the other buildings in the woods?
We.
I suppose you have to go to far end.
No, I mean, they're within the area of land that we purchased. You can still see in the little piece of woodland that we own, you can still see the bases of 26, 27, 28, 29, and the dispensary. You can still see the flat spots in the woodland as to where they are, and if you go and kick in the moss and the fallen leaf mould and things, you can still see bits of the concrete bases. And if you walk further up into the woods, you can see quite a lot more of them as well.
But you're not going that far in, are you?
No, and that's outside the area of the village that we bought, but I say about in the piece of woodland we own behind 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you can still see three of the bases of the other properties that were around.
Mm-hmm. What do you think it must have been like to be involved in building the dam all those years ago and living here? It must have been a mixture of luxurious in houses that had electricity and water flushing toilets, but also incredibly hard.
Yes, I mean the type of construction and the method of construction would have been, you know, very, very arduous work, and you know, they didn't have the luxury. I mean, although they had some machinery available to them, they didn't have the luxury of the sort of machinery that we build with these days. But as many people who visited, you know, comment how, you know, Spartan the houses appear now and how cold they must have been. If you put it in the context of the 20s, they would have been very, very luxurious properties to a lot of people. I mean, assuming that there's a fairly itinerant workforce to some degree, probably coming out of either Manchester or West Cumberland, with probably still in a back-to-back terraced housing and outside loos, they were coming to, you know, semi-detached or bunkhouse accommodation with, you know, all services and flushing toilets and inside. And in those ways, you know, we stand and look at it, and they would have been very, very desirable properties. And again, if there were people who appreciated the countryside was every bit as beautiful then as it is now. So there would have been some people who would have missed the hustle and bustle of the towns, but anybody else who'd got any sense would have enjoyed and loved working around here. I think what is interesting, if you look at the photographs from that stage, you know, there weren't any trees around here, and what people see now as a village within a wood, it wasn't a wood then. You know, the forestation which has happened has partly been planting that the water board has done. You know, the conifer plantation between here and the dam was all planted by the water board as landscaping to shield the front of the dam from view from afar. A lot of the woodland around the area of the village that we've been developing is just self-seeded native afforestation being in, and predominantly the tree species that we have are, you know, the frontier species, silver birch, bird cherry, predominantly within the village, because they're just what comes along first and what's seeded itself first. The big stand of Scots pine that run across the back of the village behind 54 down to 66 was, I'm told, planted by the water board in relatively recent times, and you know, it wasn't a wood in those days. It was just, you know, open countryside.
Mm-hmm. And you've got a connection, family connection with this area.
Well, this is one of these very strange, provident things. If you believe in things, and I'm a great believer in fate in life as I get older and soppier. But no, fate is a very strange thing. And when Trevor and I were looking at this development, and it got to the point where we'd been sort of considering it and looking at it, and I got one home one day and mentioned to my wife that, guess what we've been looking at or something. It then transpired that as a child she spent an awful lot of time here. Her parents at the time and the property she grew up in was only just down the valley at Knype. And number two, which was the post office for many, many years, was actually lived in and run by my father-in-law's aunt, if that's not too complicated a connection to know. So Aunt Maud lived in number two until her death in mid-90s sometime, I think.
What was her last name?
I haven't a clue.
Sylvia might know that one.
We'll have to phone a friend. Yes. Have to phone a friend for that one. But yes, no, that was just an amazing piece of
coincidence.
And as I say, I'm just a believer in fate and that sort
so
of
thing. So had you been to Burnbanks before, years before the project
No, it wasn't. It wasn't anywhere that
you know,
I personally knew from any time. My only other involvement into this area, you know, was through my wife and her family. And I say even at that stage, I didn't know of her connections to this place at Burnbanks, and had certainly not been up here before it came up for sale. And we came along having a look, and it then turned out to be where she'd all but grown up.
Very strange. Yes.
Mm.
Yes. So in the course of your 18 months on this site, you must have met quite a few people.
Yes.
who've either lived here or were coming to have a look to see what you were doing.
Yes, I think that, you know, there has been an awful lot of interest in what we've been doing, and obviously, you know, a lot of the local people have been paying us visits and having a look round. But I think the awareness of the area, you know, heightened by what the History Society has been doing in its project, has, you know, brought more people along. Some, no doubt, coming along to say goodbye to what was here before. Mm. You know, others just coming back to remember. There's obviously been a number of people who have been quite regular visitors to Burnbanks, you know, people who, you know, had connections here, you know, years ago, and who've continued to, you know, although they might now be living, you know, all over the country, you know, who've kept turning up every few years just to have a look and you know, show their children where they started off and where they grew up. So, you know, it has been a very fascinating project to be part of, and in what might seem a very strange way, I mean, I think Trevor and I feel quite honoured to have been a part of that transformation, because it's in property developing, you know, you usually come along to a greenfield site or a disused farm or a old hospital or something similar to that, which doesn't really have a story to tell, and to come into a still living community, to come into an entire village and recreate it and rebuild it is, I think, an honour is not too strong a word to describe it, and it makes you also very, very sensitive and aware of what the village has meant to so many people, and how it has been a community, how it's been a lifelong home for some people. I mean, one of the tenants that was was living here when we first started work. He'd been here from 1929 as a 6 month old baby, and you know, we come along, and in a very short length of time, in a two and a half year period, we'll have started and finished the redevelopment of the village, and that's just a blink of the eye in the lifetime of the people who, you know, have been Burnbanks and have been the village. You know, no community is anything without the people. It's not the bricks and mortars, it's the people, and you know, you're treading on those people's lives and memories and histories, and you know, we hope we've been sympathetic to that, and it does have quite a deep meaning to us to have done such a very unusual development project, really.
What sort of people have you got moving in?
Range
of people?
Fortunately, for the sake of the community, the National Parks Planning Policy has ensured that there's a local occupancy restriction to the properties. So the people who are coming to live here either have to already been living or currently working in an area which is that part of Eden District Council which is in the National Park and the parish of Shap. So in a simple geographical area from the M6 at Shap Summit, it's west of the motorway and then south of the A66. Although the top little corner of that from Yanwath, Clifton, Eamont Bridge, they're outside of that area, but in simple terms, it's that triangle bordered by the M6 and the A66, but as I say, a little bit of the two or three villages closest to Penrith are outside of that area. So you know, it's quite a tight geographical area. So you know, all our people here have got that connection, and possibly initially I anticipated we might be attracting more the older generations, more towards the retirement end of the spectrum, partly because of the location, partly because the house type as a two-stroke three-bedroom bungalow was never going to be appropriate accommodation for large families, and you know, although it's nice accommodation for one or two children, which is probably what most people have these days, you know, it fell short of being larger family accommodation. But that
you had to follow the
flow. We were completely restricted by the planning process to the same external footprint of the building as the prefabs did. So that set the scene for the sort of type of property. But against my initial prejudice to the properties of the people who've bought property here already, we have got people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s and 70s, I can probably say with certainty, we've managed to attract the complete spectrum of ages, you know, from young newlywed couples through to whatever, some retired people, and we have a few children coming in. We don't have a lot coming in as yet, but you know, we have got a spattering of children in amongst those people.
So there'll be a generation growing up.
So there will be another
similar experiences to the original.
So there will be another generation of people who can remember back to their childhood from Burnbanks.
Yes. Right. Can you think of anything else?
I don't think of anything else.
Would you be interested in living here?
That's my wife would love to come and live here. I in another 10 years I might be ready to live here. I'm not quite sure I'm quite ready to.
I've had mixed experiences from some of the people who used to live here many years ago, and some now say no, it's too isolated, too far to the shops. Other people say yes, they'd like to.
It's a fantastic location. It has to be a superb location for children to grow up in. You know, the freedom that the kids can have here, the way they can just go exploring up the fells and down in the woods. I hadn't thought that. United Utilities don't like it. but that sort of freedom, there aren't many places left where you feel at ease giving your children that much freedom. It's a freedom I had as a child, but you know, it's not the freedom we give our children these days in most locations, unfortunately. But there we go.
Yes. When do you expect that you'll finish completely?
We should be finished completely by the middle of next year, by the middle of 2006. We're just now starting the demolition of the remaining properties, which will take approximately 6 months to build, with a bit of downtime over Christmas and the winter again, especially since it's going to be the worst winter since records began.
So I heard, yeah.
Because they can't even get the forecast right for tomorrow. I don't know how they can get the forecast right for winter. But no, we should be all done and finished by the early part of the summer next year.
Yeah, well, I think it'll look pretty good.
Well, I'm certainly pleased with how it's turning out. I obviously have a slightly prejudiced view on on how it's turning out, but you know, I hope other people do think that it's turning out well. I think certainly the comments that have got back to us wholeheartedly have been along the same tack, that it's, you know, people have been delighted at long last to see the village being restored, and many people have been saddened by how derelict it had become through years and years of neglect, and how, you know, sad it was that, you know, if its redevelopment and rebuilding had started sooner, you know, the profile of the community might well have been slightly different. Some people probably would have stayed longer if they'd thought something was eventually going to happen, but I think an awful lot of years had gone by with no clear direction as to what was going to happen, or lots of promises that something was going to happen one day, but it just went on and on and on, that gradually it was rapidly heading to being empty.
So it's got to be better than that.
I would have thought so.
Yes. Is it a shame in some ways that there can't be a bit more of a village with facilities and some sort of a focus?
Yes, I mean,
that's not part of the plans, obviously.
No, I mean, being as we are in the National Park, I mean, any prospect of any additional buildings is absolutely zero. But then, you know, you look at Bampton, which is a settlement, is many times bigger than Burnbanks is ever now capable of being, and even in Bampton, you know, they struggle to keep any of the local services available. In some small way, the 16 extra households that will exist at Burnbanks will, you know, at least put a little bit more into the usage of the services in Bampton. But I mean, it's one of the very sad things of rural life, that the, you know, a lot of the smaller villages just can't commercially support the services that they used to do. In some small way, Burnbanks will help, yeah, Bampton's community services a little bit, but you know, there's nothing like enough people out here to support anything else, really. Looking at me, my site plan for any other inspiration of anything else that might be of interest, but I can't think of anything else.
That's all right. That's been very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.